seemed like a blink of an eye to me. We were gone for the better part, from here from the studio, for the better part of the week. Last week on Issues, Etc., broadcasting from the 2005 Symposia Series at Concordia Theological Seminary. And for me, it was just like a blink of an eye. Here we are right back, live Monday on Issues, Etc. It's the 24th of January, and during this first hour of the program, Rita Marker will join us. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court's refusal today to reinstate this Florida law passed to keep Sherry Schindler Schiavo hooked to a feeding tube. We're going to talk about the law, the Supreme Court's decision, and Terry's chances of survival after the Supreme Court's refusal to reinstate that law with Rita Marker here in the first 10 minutes of Issues, Etc. So Dr. Gene Rudd will join us also here in the first hour. We'll talk about the impact of legalized abortion on medical ethics, 30-plus years of decriminalized abortion, and we'll get an update on the FDA and the morning-after pill with Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical Association here in the first hour of the program. Now, in the second hour, you're going to have to listen very carefully. We're going to be listening to and evaluating this sermon that was preached at the prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. during the inauguration festivities. You might have seen it on television, gatherings of all the religious luminaries from around the country. The president and all the other people involved in the inauguration were there. In the second hour of the program, we're just going to listen to the sermon that was delivered by Mark Craig, who's the pastor at Highland Park United Methodist Church in Dallas, Texas. Big church. Big church. He delivers the sermon. We'll see how it stacks up in the second hour of Issues, Etc. Then, in the third hour, a couple things to do. Dr. Jeff Waltz will be our guest. We'll talk about President Bush's second term here as it begins this week. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. And then we'll round off today's conversation talking with Bill Beckman about some pro-life legislation in Illinois. And just after that, Pam Fichter will join us to talk about pro-life legislation in the state of Missouri. Bill is from Illinois Right to Life, and Pam is from Missouri Right to Life. That's the last part of Issues, Etc. today. Now, before we get started, I have three people that I want to thank. There's so many we could thank after our time at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. But the three individuals who are of particular help to us at a time when we really needed the help up there, Randy Short from Fort Wayne, Indiana, was there. He was helping us. They were helping us unload and get on the road when we thought we might have to spend the night because it was going to take us some time. They were very helpful. Also, Tom Bartsch from Phoenix, Arizona was very helpful. And Stan Slonkowski was not only helpful in carrying stuff around. These are three Issues, Etc. fans, by the way. Stan was also helpful in doing a little computer work for us while we were there at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. So Randy, Tom, and Stan, thank you very much for your help when we were in Fort Wayne. Rita Marker is our guest here for the first 15 minutes. She's director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide based in Steubenville, Ohio. Rita, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you.
After the Supreme Court's decision today, Rita, what are Terry Schindler Schiavo's chances of survival?
Well, they are not looking good at this point. Now, true, there are some other legal avenues that her attorneys may take, but those seem not likely to be successful. And I say not likely because nothing is ever impossible. Today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to not hear the case from Florida was very unfortunate. It was not a case, by the way, as is being reported, that they made the decision that the law was unconstitutional, or that they made the decision that her feeding tube should be removed. Actually, what had happened is that Governor Bush had brought the case because he had said that his rights were violated because he, as governor, had been protecting a citizen of the state, and that he, as governor, had signed a law, and that his rights as governor were therefore being usurped by the judiciary in Florida. Now, that seems like, you know, the sort of thing that makes people's eyes glaze over. But it's important to know that that was a biggie, because it was whether or not the governor could exercise the rights to protect a citizen. And the U.S. Supreme Court, by refusing to take the case, in essence said, no, we're going to let stand what the Florida Supreme Court did. And so that's where that stands right now. There are several other avenues that are being taken by the attorneys that now are representing Terry's parents. I don't know if most people are aware, but the attorney who had been protecting Terry throughout most of this, all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court until that particular case took place, because that was not with the parents, that was with Governor Bush. Up until then, Pat Anderson had been the attorney who had done just a magnificent job. And that's not to say anything against the new attorneys, because they're also very, very good. But there was one part of one case that Pat Anderson had brought, and that was to challenge Michael Schiavo's guardianship of Terry Schiavo. And since the new attorneys have taken over, they have not done anything with that particular situation, which, in my opinion, and I'm just one attorney, and so everybody has different views. In my opinion, that would have been and could be the most important case, but whether it's too late now and whether the court would even entertain it, because it was going along until and through August, and then no one dealt with it after that. So I'm concerned about that, and I don't know if they're going to pick that back up or not.
So it is important to note here the two things you said just a minute ago, that the Supreme Court's refusal to hear this case does not amount to them either declaring the Florida law that was keeping Terry alive unconstitutional, nor does it amount to them ordering the feeding tube to be removed. They simply said, we are, for whatever reason, they don't have to give a reason, and they didn't, we're not going to hear the case.
That's
about
right.
This law.
Because when the Supreme Court refuses to hear a case, then the lower court ruling stands.
All right. Now, let's talk a bit about that guardianship. And you said it's a bit contested, and the new team of lawyers haven't done much with it. If they were to be successful in challenging the guardianship of Michael Schiavo over his wife, what would that mean for Terry?
Well, that would be incredible because, again, many people may not realize that Michael's authority in this case does not derive from the fact that he is her husband. And, of course, he is her estranged husband. He's living with another woman and has two children. But it isn't through his status as her legal husband that he is making the decisions for her. All of his authority stems from the fact that soon after her injury, he petitioned the court to become her court-appointed guardian. And he did that very soon after her injury. And then as her court-appointed guardian, he's the one that brought the malpractice case, that brought in all of the settlement money that he has since spent on court cases. Now, as a guardian, you have certain obligations. And as a guardian, you are answerable to the court and must do certain things, or your guardianship is not effective. As Terry's guardian, the law required that annually he file a report about the status of the ward, in other words, the person that he is the guardian of, in this case, his wife, and that he file a plan for her care. And all guardians are supposed to do that. They're supposed to file this saying how they are going to care for the ward over the next year, what the status is of that person, what sorts of interventions, therapies, and so forth. And that's all supposed to be part of the court record. Florida law also says that the total authority of the guardian is derived only from that plan. Well, Michael Schiavo has not filed a plan, or at least had not filed a plan as of August, for several years. So he had no legal authority in the state of Florida to be making decisions for her, because the law itself says that without that plan being filed with the court, the guardian doesn't have any authority. If, in fact, then the court were to find that he didn't have authority, he would no longer be, he could be ousted as the guardian and someone else could be appointed. And in August, just as the case about the constitutionality of the law referred to as Terry's law was going to the Florida Supreme Court, and that's where most people were, you know, watching what was going on. But at the same time, Pat Anderson, who was then the attorney for Terry's parents, had brought that case related to the guardianship, and the court had ordered Michael to be present for depositions on several occasions, and he had not shown up. One time he said, well, the judge didn't order me to do it in writing. And then another time he said, well, something was going on in his fiancée's life, as her father was ill or something of that sort, and he just kept not showing up. And so he was very reluctant to be deposed. And that was really a crucial sort of thing, because he could have lost guardianship, therefore he would have lost the authority to make decisions for Terry. And yet, since August, when the attorneys were changed, apparently there hasn't been anything done in that at all. And so that's where it has stopped.
So clear this up for me. I'm just a little confused, and that is, has Governor Jeb Bush, does he have standing, and has he brought any challenge to Michael Schiavo's guardianship of Terry?
Governor Bush, I believe, has done everything that he can, short of ordering the state protective services to intervene.
And could he do that as well?
I think he possibly could. Well, I won't say I think he possibly could. He could. But again, you have a situation where state protective service, and there have been a number of overtures made to the state entities that do protect people with disabilities, but they have not responded. And that was why Terry's law was passed, because the governor took the action that he felt would be the most effective. And certainly it was the boldest action, but also it saved her life. Remember, she would have been dead in October of 2003 had he not done that. So while he could do that, the question is, would it be effective? And that's a question I can't answer.
Would you say at this point that all reasonable legal avenues to try and preserve Terry Schindler Schiavo's life have been exhausted?
I don't think there's ever a time that I would say that they have all been exhausted. And I'm not as close to the case now as I was before September. But I do know that the attorneys who have been working on it are excellent attorneys, and I'm sure they're going to do everything possible. And if people might keep in mind, when we're talking about a case of capital punishment, even down to the minute that there is the needle put in the arm of the convicted killer, there are all kinds of legal maneuvers going on. Well, certainly in a case such as this, where you have an innocent disabled woman, certainly there will be all kinds of court maneuvers taking place, and hopefully one of them will be successful.
If you'd like to keep updated on the case of Terry Schindler Schiavo, check out the International Task Force website. It's the internationaltaskforce.org. That's the website for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, internationaltaskforce.org. Rita Marker is the director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Rita, thank you again for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
We're going to be speaking now to Dr. Gene Rudd. He's a regular guest here on the program. We've got to get an update on two things. One, the FDA and the morning after pill. But first, we're going to be talking about the impact of legalized abortion after 30-plus years on medical ethics. It used to be that you go into the doctor's office. I was in the vet's office yesterday, folks. Not yesterday, before yesterday. There was a pledge on the wall, the veterinarian, about what he was going to do. It was kind of a typical thing that you would find in a vet's office. What he was going to do to care for my pet. What he would and wouldn't do. The kind of care that he pledged himself to give to my dog. Well, I kind of value that. I hope he's a nice guy. And I hope that he takes that pledge seriously. You know, you're hard-pressed to find the old Hippocratic Oath on the wall of a doctor who's caring for you and your children. What has 30 years of legalized abortion done to medical ethics in America? Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Director of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Rudd, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, let's talk about 30-plus years here. Is the Hippocratic Oath, has it gone completely the way of the world in medical ethics?
Well, I'm afraid so. There are very few schools today that administer the Hippocratic Oath. One of the things that our organization does to to help remedy that is that we come along beside and have oath-taking ceremonies at many of the campuses across the country at the time of graduation, and we do this as an extracurricular activity for many of the medical students who are graduating. But I think it's important that we have a foundation of knowing who we are, having some values that we follow. You know, every society that has lost its root in the value system that guided it, every society that's done that has disintegrated. And unfortunately, we see some of the effects of that, early effects of that, even in healthcare, as we have lost those values that have guided Western civilization, and particularly medicine, that were talked about in the Hippocratic Oath. You know, I will not kill, even if asked to do so. People don't teach you that in medical school anymore because it's sort of up for grabs. Are we going to kill or are we not going to kill in the profession of medicine? We think it's important to go back to those fundamentals and say we're not going to kill, even if asked to do so.
Paint us a picture of the medical ethics landscape, if you would. What issues, in addition to abortion, are now facing doctors and medical professionals, and of course the whole medical industry, that do stem directly from the decriminalization of abortion and the ethical slip that began 30 years ago?
Well, we got on this slippery slope with the hard cases, the tough cases. And, you know, all of us, if we heard of some of these cases, our hearts would go out to them. The very tragic conditions for some women having unwanted babies, or maybe having maybe they were injured in a backstreet coat hanger type abortion, and you know they felt desperate and didn't have any alternatives, and they had serious complications or died. Our hearts go out to every one of those cases. But because we changed the rules on those tough cases and essentially took away all the rules so that now in most states you can have an abortion for any reason at any time, we have opened the door to where life is no longer sacred. And we can just, by choice, by individual choice and sometimes by society choice, we can just say, well, we're going to add a new form of human life to this list of lives that we don't think are worth living, lives that we think it's okay for us to take the life because we have some other agenda or some other motive, something to gain. So therefore, we've diminished the quality and the value and the respect and the protection for life in general. And you see that now propagated all the way to the other extreme of human life with physician-assisted suicide and the whole euthanasia issue. And these things would never have happened if it hadn't been for the tough cases associated with abortion in the 60s and early 70s.
Lest our listeners become unduly alarmed, I mean, all of this is very alarming, and every year that passes with Roe v. Wade still on the books is another year of alarm, but lest they become unduly alarmed, should they get the impression that the average doctor out there is completely, now has a complete disregard for the Hippocratic Oath, for the ethics under which he practices his science and his art?
Yes, they should. They should be very concerned about that. And I think they should be alarmed enough to determine, make that determination in their specific relationship with their doctor. They ought to know where their doctor stands. He or she may not have a value for life that may affect the decision-making that you two will have to make at some critical times in your management. So you need to know that ahead of time. And I don't think anymore we can determine that every doctor might be, I mean, doctors might be nice, they might do a good job, but what happens when it gets to critical life-saving decisions? Will they have those same value systems that you do and seek to protect that? Or will they, like many of the doctors in Holland now, say, there's a mouse that needs to, that's taking a bed, some person body's taking up a bed space and a mouth that needs to be fed, and they're not contributing to society, and therefore they're a liability, we need to get rid of them, and they can and they do. And our medical community is drifting that way, and more doctors are embracing that philosophy. And since very few medical schools now require an oath or even teach that type of ethics, then I think we need to question every doctor out there. And, you know, we encourage our doctors to hang that modified Hippocratic Oath, the Christian doctor's oath, in their office and make that known to their patients.
So specifically, what kind of questions should we be asking our doctors in order to determine what ethic they operate under?
I think you need to ask them about life value questions. If you have an obstetrician gynecologist, you need to say, doctor, do you do abortions? If you have a primary care doctor, an internist, or someone like that, and they're going to potentially be taking care of you or your family member through an end-of-life situation, you need to say, what is your opinion on physician-assisted suicide? Doctor, how do you feel about the Hippocratic Oath and the tenets of it? Now, remember, the Hippocratic Oath went through changes through history, and the original Hippocratic Oath, of course, sweared allegiance to Apollo and involved Aesculapius. But the oaths have been changed so that you don't have to swear allegiance to Apollo anymore. But there was a modification of the oath in 1948, and then it started just changing willy-nilly in the 70s. Now, did that date strike any chord with you? At the same time Roe v. Wade was passed, the Hippocratic Oaths began to be changed by each institution, changing it to whatever they thought was appropriate. So finally, it became so watered down and said nothing that most schools did away with it. So if the doctor says, well, I support the Hippocratic Oath, then you need to ask the next question, well, what of that oath do you support? Do you know what it says, and do you really support the tenets of it, where it says, you know, I'm not going to kill an unborn baby, I'm not going to take a life? So those are the kind of questions you need to ask. Find out where your doctor is.
One of the parts of that oath that probably most lay people are most familiar with is first, do no harm. And I have heard arguments made from medical ethics experts, so-called experts, who say, look, now that's kind of the driving principle here. And so we have to decide what's harm, harm to society, harm to the greater good of a family. So we might assist in a suicide because it would do harm to for this person to continue to drain the family's resources. And we're really, after all, then following the spirit of the Hippocratic Oath by doing no harm.
That oath has to do with a doctor-patient relationship. Let me put it the other way around. Let's put it the emphasis where it needs to be. It has to do with a patient-doctor relationship. And that oath has to do with how you're going to treat that individual patient, each and every individual patient. So when you say, well, I'm not going to do any harm, we have a fancy word for that. We call it non-maleficence. And we say, we're not going to harm that person. We're not going to intentionally do anything. Now, in the process of maybe getting rid of treating appendicitis, we're going to operate and we're going to make an incision, which might be painful, but it's for the greater good to ultimately do what's good for that individual patient. Society is not our patients. The people in society, each one as an individual, has to have that determination about how the oath should be applied.
Dr. Gene Rudd is our guest, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. He joins us from their base in Bristol, Tennessee. We're talking about the impact of legalized abortion on medical ethics, and after the break, we'll continue this conversation and also get an update on the FDA and the morning after pill. That debate continues as well. Will the morning after pill be available to women 16 and older without a prescription? We'll find out when we come back from this break. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then when we conclude our conversation with Dr. Gene Rudd, we will be hearing from and reacting to a leader of a pro-choice group on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. We'll be hearing some of the things that they've said. One of the things I found most interesting is that some of these pro-choice groups didn't believe they'd have to be around for 30 years, and yet they are. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At the end of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus speaks the words, "Go make disciples by baptizing and teaching." What did Jesus give the church to teach? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church. Discourses in Matthew is $29.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for January, Discourses in Matthew, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or go online to our website, issuesetc.org, and look under the What's New section for more information and a way to order the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Discourses in Matthew, Jesus Teaches the Church, by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. David Scare.
This Global Minute turns your attention to the world of those caught up in the false religion of Islam, so you'll be reminded to pray for their salvation. Prayer is a way Muslims around the globe put order in their day. A website called Islam Online describes why Muslims pray 5 times a day. When a person stops praying, his faith becomes weak and the mildest blows cause it to crumble. Islam is built upon 5 pillars, and the second pillar is establishing this prayer ritual. A verse from the Quran teaches, "Successful are the believers who humble themselves in their prayers." When Muslims pray, they believe they're uniting their heart, mind, soul, and body in obedience to Allah. As Christians, we can pray with the confidence that if we ask anything according to God's will, He hears us. So let's pray for Islamic followers around the world to discover how Jesus Christ longs for them to receive His grace. Learn more about Muslims at missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I've heard it said that you know you're getting older when you have the answers, but nobody's asking the questions. Well, I guess I'm not old enough yet because my little mind ponders many, many questions. For example, who was the first person who decided to crack open and try eating that ugly thing called a lobster? How did people dry their hair before we had handheld blow dryers? How do TV people put that imaginary yellow line on the football field? Or, when you are watching baseball, how do they fake those electronic ads on the wall behind the batter? When you buy a new dress shirt, it is folded and stuck with pins. How do they get all those pins in the shirt so neatly and in just the right places? And how is it that you don't get stuck because you forgot to take one out? Why do people say, "I talk to him or her before he died"? When else would you do it? Does anyone miss the National Hockey League? Why, when your plane is delayed, does the pilot come on the PA and say, "Thank you for your patience"? I mean, did we have a choice? And why are women called the weaker sex? And my final question, why aren't people awed by this experience of life?
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, and Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the conversion of St. Paul. I guess we could probably say the conversion of Saul, although we're going to find out about that name change. Does it really have anything to do with his conversion? We'll be talking with Dr. Peter Scare of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, tomorrow on Issues Etc. Dr. Gene Rudd is our guest, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. He joins us from Bristol, Tennessee. We've been talking here about the effect of a legalized abortion for 30-plus years on medical ethics. One final question in that respect, Dr. Rudd. We hear so often from the pro-choice side that this decision of whether or not to have a child post-pregnancy should be left to a woman's conscience. It's between her conscience, her God, and her doctor. It sounds as though you have very little confidence in what the doctor might recommend to such a woman who might say, "Well, my conscience says it's okay, and I guess God must say it's okay." Could there be any stop in the doctor saying, "No, this is not okay"?
Well, you know, we need to encourage more of that because fewer and fewer doctors are willing to take a stand. The concept of healthcare right of conscience, meaning that the moral values of the doctor that can be introduced into the doctor-patient relationship, is becoming sort of an obsolete concept, and we're lobbying hard actually to bring that back to front because we're saying that doctors are not just puppets. They are not there just to respond to the wishes of their patients. They have to make value judgments, too, as what's good for themselves to participate in, what's good for patients. What's often overlooked in this, and the impact on healthcare, you ask about abortion, is the enormous physical and psychological and spiritual impact on that abortion has had on women over the last 30 years. And we're seeing that impact throughout healthcare. It's created a terrific drain on healthcare resources, not to mention the suffering, physical and mental suffering on women. This has been swept under the carpet. So it has an effect on all of healthcare as well as individual patients. So should we be saying something about this as doctors, or should we just capitulate with whatever the patient wants? And it's my choice. I want it. You've got to give it. And this is the way the pro-abortion advocates are saying, you know, doctors shouldn't have a choice. You just give the patient what they want. That's not good healthcare. It's not good healthcare for that individual who doesn't get told all the consequences of their decision. And it's not good societal policy for us to say we're going to let the liberty and pursuit of happiness rights of the patient trump all the liberty and pursuit of rights of the doctor.
Tell us about the morning after pill and what's happening in the halls of the FDA with regard to this drug.
Nothing is happening that we can see, but I'm sure a lot is happening behind the scenes. They were scheduled to release a decision this last week, and they did not. And that's because this is a sticky wicket. This decision has a lot of political pressure from both sides. They're going to be crucified. The FDA and the persons making this decision are going to be crucified by the side that doesn't get the ruling that they want. And I think they're being very careful and very deliberate for that reason. But basically they're saying, you know, we want the morning after pill to be available over the counter for all ages. And the bar has, you know, Bar Laboratory said, well, we'll come back and restrict that to have it just available for young women over 16, since there weren't good studies on what would happen to young women under 16. But even if you look at the studies, and even if you look at the projections of morning after pill, there's reason to say, wait a minute, do we really want to be promoting this as easily available as toothpaste? And I think the answer is definitely no. It's called Plan B for a reason, by the way. It's not Plan A. It's not the way we most want to go. One example is the far and away, the most common reason that young women go to see a doctor is for contraceptive or pregnancy treatment. If we remove their need to go to a doctor for contraception to get a prescription, we're going to remove them from the very environment that has the best chance of protecting their health and helping them avoid a lot of serious complications. We're going to remove them from the environment that's most likely to detect their sexually transmitted disease or give them advice about their sexuality. And I just see that as a desperate failure on our society if we remove that. Another concern is that there is evidence that making these available will increase sexual promiscuity, increasing sexually transmitted disease, and perhaps increasing the pregnancy rate. The whole argument for having a morning after pill available over the counter is that it was going to reduce the unwanted pregnancy rate. There was a major study just released this month in the Journal of the American Medical Association that says that's not happening. They did a study where they made this available to people by giving it to them, young women, down around age 15 and up, and they made the pills available to them, age 15 to 24. They made the pills available to some group just by giving it to them. Others, they said, well, you can just drop in the pharmacy and pick it up. Others, they had to get a prescription. So they had three groups. What was interesting is that the pregnancy rate did not decrease. The incidence of sexuality did increase in the group that had the morning after pill available to them. So they had more sex and more unprotected intercourse and more sexually transmitted diseases, but it did not decrease the pregnancy rate from the other groups. So the whole argument for having it available is non-existent. It doesn't work that way.
I'd like your reaction to two things that I found in the paper from the Associated Press, taken from an editorial that was published by the New England Journal of Medicine back in April. First, this. They wrote, a treatment for any other condition, from hangnail to headache to heart disease, with a similar record of safety and efficacy, they're speaking here about the morning after pill, would be approved quickly. They say, of course, that the only reason this is not being approved by the FDA is conservative political politics are having their influence. Your reaction?
Well, there were certainly some very credible scientists who reviewed this. And despite the political pressure to approve it, they stood their ground and said, one, there's not adequate safety studies to say that this is not going to do harm. There are legitimate safety concerns about this product. There are legitimate safety concerns about the repetitive use of it and the avoidance of better choices. Remember, I said this is Plan B. It's not Plan A. We ought to be promoting Plan A. Now, I really disagree with the concept that likens our sexual choices to whether we're going to have a spontaneous headache or not and need a remedy for that. If we're allowing product to be available over the counter that's going to let millions of young women give more permission to them to go out and have high-risk sexual activity and have more sexually transmitted diseases and all the consequences of the pregnancies and abortions that result from that, and we're equating that with a hangnail, I don't think so. This is very narrow-minded, and there is a political and personal agenda behind someone who would say that.
Also from that same editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine in April, quote, in this case, there is no medical dispute. Rather, the delay results from the concern of some groups that the availability of the drug may have a corrupting influence on sexual behavior. And here's the point I'd like your reaction to. If easy access to the drug could have such an influence, it would seem that the battle had already been lost. Your reaction?
Well, what we're doing as a society is condoning behavior for all people that many families find to be unacceptable. So what we're doing to our teenagers is saying, from a society standpoint, while parents are saying, don't speed, you know, don't drive your car too fast, the society is saying, yeah, well, let's give you a sports car, and we might tell you that cops sit on certain corners so you can slow down there, but you just drive that sports car any way you want to, as fast as you want to, and then suffer the consequences of the wrecks that would result from that. You know, we're sending mixed messages. On one hand, we're saying to parents, we don't want you involved in the sexual decisions of your teenagers. We don't want you to discourage them from having sex because it's just a natural thing to do, and we're just going to have to live with those consequences. But on the other hand, we're saying to them and running ads on television that says, you know, be involved in your teenagers so they don't get involved in drugs. But if you look at the harmful effects, the magnitude of the problem for sexuality is greater than the magnitude of the problem for drugs. And the parents can have an equal positive influence on their teenagers, whether it's drugs or for sexuality, if we would just let them put that decision-making back in the home and not let society try to condone a free sexual lifestyle with all the medical and psychological complications of that in the face of parents who are trying to say, no, we don't want this for our children.
CMDAHome.org is the website address for the Christian Medical and Dental Association, CMDAHome.org. Dr. Gene Rudd is the Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. He joined us from Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Rudd, thanks again for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
So as we remember here, the 32nd anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision on January 22nd, 1973, let's spend the last few minutes of this hour here hearing from one of the leaders of a pro-choice movement. This is the Reverend Carlton Veazey. He's president of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, and he's talking here first about the religious groups that support choice and his organization.
We have 40 denominations and religious organizations that form the coalition. Our member organizations, such as the Presbyterian Church, the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, Unitarian Universalists, and many Jewish organizations.
Now, right at the outset, I want you to think about this, folks, because you might be a member of one of these churches and be pro-life, and you might have talked to your pastor and said, hey, pastor, what's your position? Well, he says, I'm pro-life, and this congregation is pro-life. Well, what about our church body, pastor? You might want to check out the website for the Religious Coalition for the Reproductive Choice and see whether or not your denomination is actually a member of that organization. It might tell you a little bit about your church's position. You know, the church might even hold the position that abortion is a woman's decision to make, neither pro nor con on abortion. That is sometimes the case with these more liberal church bodies. But their membership in an organization like this, the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, is hardly a neutral position. Here again, the Reverend Veazey says that this organization is fighting to keep abortion legal.
The Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice was founded 32 years ago as a result of Roe v. Wade. At that time, we thought we would be in business maybe 5 or 10 years because we thought it was settled. But 32 years have passed, and we're still fighting the same fight.
And thank God they are. Not thank God that they're fighting the fight for choice, but thank God that they have to. They thought they'd only have to be in business 5 or 10 years. Well, here's Roe v. Wade, maybe 1980. We don't have to fight any longer than that, because after all, the Supreme Court has spoken, and this is going to go over well with the American people, and Roe v. Wade will be just another footnote in the history books, and people will hardly remember when there was such a thing as illegal abortion. 5, 10 years max. That's all the longer we'll have to keep this fight up. Well, thanks be to God, it's 32 years later, and they still have to keep up the fight. Now, what would be better? What would be better is if all the organizations could stop fighting about it and Roe v. Wade could be overturned. But since that's not going to happen anytime soon, being the realists we are, it is good news to hear that the choice groups, and in particular the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, think, they seem to be saying, I don't see why we have to keep on fighting this battle. It's such a no-brainer. Why do we keep on? The pro-life community has spoken loud and clear. We could speak louder. We could speak clearer. But it is a credit and a kudo to the pro-life community that organizations like this have to keep funding themselves and keep their organizations up and running because the battle continues. It is interesting. I don't think I've ever heard a pro-choice leader talk about how they had underestimated the public's sentiment on Roe v. Wade. But obviously, at least in the case of the Reverend Veazey, they did underestimate the pro-life sentiment on this issue. Now, Carlton Veazey of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice says that aborting the human life isn't in any way immoral. Listen to this.
The fetus is not a person. As some of us argue that position, some argue differently. That's the more reason why we can't have any one set of people saying whether it's a person. I think that because of the various understandings of this issue, is the more reason why we ought to leave it to a woman and her conscience to make that decision.
The Reverend Veazey is an African-American man. Now, how would he react if I said, look, we're talking about antebellum South. Look, slavery, we can't allow any one group to say that the slave is a full citizen and a full human deserving of protection under law. Since there's so many different opinions about this, we really need to leave it to the individual conscience of the slave owner to make up his mind on that issue. Well, of course, he'd never say that, would he? But in the case of the unborn, for some reason, he thinks it's wrong that any one group be able to say, now notice he didn't say any one group be able to say whether or not the unborn child is a human being. What he said was, no one group should be able to say that the unborn is a human being. He doesn't want anyone saying that the unborn is a human being. That's, in effect, what he has to say there. Actually, it seems as though I could easily turn the tables on him. Why should any one group, in particular the Religious Coalition on Reproductive Choice, be able to say that the unborn isn't a human being? If any one group can't say that the unborn is, it seems to me that, to be fair, any one group shouldn't be able to say that the unborn isn't. Makes sense to me. Veazey also says that women who believe that they were hurt by abortion should not be allowed to outlaw it for other women.
Millions of women have been helped because they've had the right to make to choose. I'm African American, and I come from the Deep South, and I know what it was like before Roe v. Wade. I know about back alley abortions. I know about women being maimed, and many of them died, while other women of means were able to have this procedure. So I think that it's been a liberating thing for many millions of women.
So he wants to balance the women who have been harmed by abortion, and the numbers are vast. And I'm not talking necessarily about physical harm, although that does occur. But women who have had an abortion regret it either secretly or openly, be they pro-choice or pro-life, and realize that this has left a hole in their life that will never be filled, and in sadly, in some cases, has left the burden of guilt in their life that they have no answer for. So women will have more abortions to punish themselves. Things like this. We've talked about it on the program. He wants to balance that against the women who have supposedly been helped by abortion. You know, he's leaving someone out of the equation. In fact, he's leaving an awful lot of someones out of the equation. What about all the women in the womb? They are women, after all. What about all the women in the womb who have had their lives taken from them through abortion? I guess he'd have to argue that they've been helped somehow, too. They're better off dead, seems to be the logic here. You know, if we're going to talk about who's been helped and who's been hurt, we cannot leave out the 3.1 million a year who are not only hurt but killed by abortion. Finally, the Reverend Carl Veazey, president of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, tries to make the religious case for abortion rights.
The religious argument in favor of abortion is one that we believe in the moral agency of women. We believe that a woman has a moral agency to make a decision about her body, a decision about when or whether to have children, according to her own conscious and religious beliefs.
It sounds so good, doesn't it? Women have a moral agency. I could just as well say, in argue of, say, child abuse, that I have a moral agency. I've got a moral agency to decide whether or not to beat my child, or for that matter, if I get a hold of them, your child. Because I have a moral agency, right? You see, it does not follow from the fact that women have a moral agency. No one's arguing about that. It does not follow from the fact that women have a moral agency that they can therefore decide to do whatever they darn well please. You see, part and parcel of having a moral agency is being able to tell the difference between a decision that is right and a decision that is morally wrong. Just because women have a moral agency doesn't mean that they can therefore decide to do whatever they want to do with regard to their unborn children. And I would reiterate by that argument the fact that I have a moral agency, and I'm sure that the Reverend Veazey would allow that I have a moral agency, does not mean that I can morally go out and beat my or your children. In fact, part and parcel of my moral agency would be the fact that I would consider such a thing wrong. Now let's hear from a pro-life leader. This is Judy Brown. She's been a guest on the program. She's president of American Life League. She says that the unique humanity of the fetus is a matter of biology, not so much of theology.
I've heard them say that a human being isn't a human being until they're born or until you can see their brain waves or whatever. But if it's really true, which the human embryologists tell us, that a person has his own personal DNA from fertilization, then obviously that's when his life begins.
Okay, so all of the other measures of what means human, what means alive, fall away when we understand the basic principle that from conception, from the unity of sperm and egg, an entirely unique individual comes into being. Now, the biologist will say it's just a matter of biology, chromosomes passing from one to another. There you go. You've got a genetically unique person. She doesn't want to bring theology into the argument. Fine. But I can also say this is where God creates, procreates a new human being that didn't exist before through this biological process. If you don't have a genetically unique person there, what do you got? A genetically unique what? It's not a kitten, it's not a dog, it's not a fish. In my experience, dogs have puppies and cats have kittens and big human beings have little human beings. This isn't brain surgery. Judy Brown also says that she doesn't understand how some churches, like the churches named by the Reverend Veazey, can support legal abortion.
This is either a total misunderstanding of the Bible or an inability to be willing to take the Bible at its word, because for anybody who claims to be religious, they understand that the fifth commandment says, thou shalt not kill.
I think it's both, Judy. I think it's both. It is both an ignorance of what the Bible teaches. That does account for some of it, but I think in more cases than not, it is an unwillingness to listen to what the Bible teaches. This is the sad, sad truth, that in those churches that were named, and just I'll come back to this, in those churches that were named by the Reverend Veazey, they know what the Bible says. It's not as though they've never opened up the book. They just choose to ignore it, or
a very fancy term for ignoring, reinterpret or reevaluate what it says. Now, lest we leave anyone out here, it is not just people in those nasty pro-choice churches like the United Methodist Church or the others that VZ named, Presbyterian Church USA, the Episcopal Church USA. There are a lot of people sitting in pro-life churches, in conservative, Bible-believing churches where they do claim to take the Word of God seriously, who are quietly and happily pro-choice. They are. And pastors, you would do well to just ask around occasionally. Do not assume that your entire membership, just because you are a pastor in a pro-life church and you take a pro-life stand when it is called, when you are called upon to do so, just because that's the case doesn't mean that your people believe you or are listening to you or are agreeing with you or, for that matter, agreeing with God's Word. Now, Judy Brown also says that the annual March for Life includes a growing number of young people. It was held there in Washington on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
All of those young people who are here under the age of 30 survived abortion. They've lived and been born during a time when abortion was protected by the law and when their lives could have been taken by abortion. And the other reason that they take abortion so seriously and come out to the March for Life is because they're here to witness for their brothers and sisters who have been aborted.
Now, we will see whether or not this generation, the Roe generation, that generation of people who are 32 years old and younger, who can all, by all rights, consider themselves survivors in an abortion culture, who have had brothers and sisters aborted before them and after them, we shall see whether or not that generation, and I'm glad to hear that Judy Brown announces more and more of them are taking part in the life demonstrations. We will see whether or not this generation is able to undo what their parents and their grandparents' generation did back in 1973, and in some cases have been doing since 1973. When we come back from this break, hour two of Issues, Etc., we're going to be listening to and evaluating a sermon from the prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., that took place during the inaugural festivities last week. The president was in attendance, as well as all the other luminaries of both the state and American civil religion. You want to listen carefully to this one, folks. I'll tell you in advance, this is a perfect example, this sermon that we're going to hear and evaluate in hour two, of American civil religion, fully blown in all of its, well, if you can call it splendor, in all of its flag waving at least. Then we'll be talking in the third hour of the program with Dr. Jeff Waltz about the second Bush term, and two guests quickly in the last part of the program, Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life and Pam Fichter of Missouri Right to Life. We'll talk about pro-life legislation in both Illinois and Missouri to round off today's Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.